Welcome to the Arts Entrepreneurship Podcast, making art work.
We highlight how entrepreneurs align their artistry, passion, and vision to create and pursue opportunities to capture value in the arts. The views expressed by guests on the Arts Entrepreneurship Podcast are solely their own and do not necessarily represent the views of the podcast or its hosts. The appearance of a guest on the podcast, the venture they represent, or reference to any product or service does not imply an endorsement or recommendation by the podcast or its hosts. The content provided is for entertainment and informational purposes only and does not constitute business advice. Here are your hosts, Andy Heiss and Nick Petrella.
Hello, podcast listeners. My name is Andy Heiss.
And I'm Nick Petrella. Serial arts entrepreneur Liz Moggins is with us today. She's a printmaker whose works are included in the Progressive Art Collection, the Cleveland Clinic, the Dalid Collection, B.F. Goodrich, the Weston Collection, and the Rice Center for Government and the Arts. She received an Ohio Arts Council Individual Artist Fellowship in 2000 and a 2005 Artist in Communities grant. Liz was awarded an Ohio Arts Council's international residency to Dresden, Germany in 2009. She has many more accolades, so we'll share her website in the show notes so you can read more about Liz and her art. Liz, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Nick and Andy. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Why don't we begin by having you give us a brief overview of your career?
Hey, I'm from a long line of farmers and nurses, drug addicts. I've had my share of financial CEOs in my family. So I think I have a little bit of all of those genetic strains. And I started drawing when I was 5 years old. And there's a picture of me where I was one of those people that used to draw with their tongue.
Is that a
and
thing?
I had a little smocking dress on. And there is actually a very famous drawing by Fairfield Porter of etching that is called Lizzie Drawing. And I have it down in my studio, and it looks just like me at five. And so I just really loved how it felt to be able to kind of lose myself in the waltz of making things. And so I knew really right away that this was my calling and the life that I wanted to have. The probably pivotal moment as I was going through high school and thriving in art classes is I had a teacher named Phyllis Fannin, who basically had gone to Kent State University. So I was like, I'm going to go to Kent State University. So I went there and really loved the idea of printmaking as this discipline that I could speak so many different languages and then I could also make multiples. I could speak the sort of commercial capitalist language, and then I had the vernacular of something that was really personal, private, one of a kind. It just seemed very versatile and really enjoyed being able to make multiples to hang on multiple aunts and friends' refrigerators. And so I went to Kent. I majored in printmaking. I also liked it because I was the only girl. So it's a very physical and aerobic discipline of the arts. I also was a painter. And soon after, I decided to go to graduate school. I took a gap year and I went to Cranbrook Academy of Art up in north of Detroit in Bloomfield Hills. And Cranbrook for me was a beautiful oasis of experimentation, reading, looking at a lot of critical theory as it relates to art. Detroit and Cleveland have a lot in common. Mm-hmm. They are these sort of kindred spirits of a challenge, but I think of great opportunity. And so I really ate and thrived in the Detroit art scene. And then coming back to Cleveland, I immediately got connected to the Cleveland Institute of Art, mm-hmm. for which I was the TA. And so I was so thrilled to be able to connect with so many students and help with processes within printmaking and support the faculty there. Mm-hmm. I soon became a faculty member. I met my first business partner of Zygote Press, Joe Soroka, mm-hmm. and connected to some of the other people that helped me found Zygote Press. And that's really the story of me starting my first entrepreneurial, maybe it's my second entrepreneurial entity. The first one was when I was at Kent. I was unfortunately in this situation where they're bringing in computers. And so that was where the galleries were. So a number of us that were trying to do our BFAs didn't have a place to do it.
I see.
So six of us ended up renting out an old antique store. We each threw in $50 a month. It was called Gallery 425. We used it as our studios. And then we ended up having our BFA exhibitions in there. And for 25, probably 30 years, it continued to be an art space for students.
That's great.
Yeah. I continue to go back, and I have taught at a lot of Northeast Ohio universities, including Lorain County Community College, Tri-C Metro, Cleveland Institute of Art, and Kent State, among many. So it really leveraged me to be able to be a huge advocate for connecting students to opportunities and just being, I think, a self-proclaimed dot connector.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was your first of many ventures, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's great. And we're going to unpack that, I think, as the interview goes on.
It's so they put the computers in the gallery space?
They did.
Okay.
You know, this was a time
sure.
where they were getting rid of a lot of printmaking, looking at it as being analog antiquated. And of course, we get along best with technology, the printmakers,
right. yeah.
With photo silk screening and a lot of digital interface and intersection. And so it was both a blessing and very sad that we were clearing out a beautiful French tool printing presses and Charles Brand presses, unfortunately putting a halt to the printmaking programs in the universities. Mm. But taking advantage of having school groups and countless artists being able to use that to be able to continue making their work.
Yeah. Yeah. So in addition to the many things that you're involved in, which we're going to talk about as we go through the through this interview, you're currently the director of the Yards Project. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and what being the director entails?
Sure. It's a kind of combination of being a curator of a collection of all hyper-local Northeast Ohio art. And it's also directing Yards Projects, which is a gallery that also supports artists from this region. There are two buildings, and we're working on our third building for the developer, Neil Vinny, who runs Dalid Group, which is a development project where he really loves these adaptive reuse buildings. Mm. One building has about 98 apartments and the other one has 51. So the gallery is literally in the lobby of this beautiful building that is in the heart of the warehouse district. And so when we have the 7 or 8 exhibitions each year, we open everything up to the public and we have great parties mm-hmm. and we're able to really turn a lot of newcomers on to the arts. The collection itself is shared in all of the halls and all of the spaces of the building.
Wow.
And so I do many art tours each year, and I'm able to really I bring students from university. I have high school tours, And so it's really a beautiful, broad representation of what Cleveland looks like and beyond. So it's been a great surprise in my life that this came along. I literally had gotten a cold call from the developer that had not known at the time that I was going to be succeeding to try to do other things in the community. And so that became an opportunity for me to go over and to look at this building. And he basically said, "Hey, I'm thinking of turning this into a gallery. Do you know anybody?" And I just said, "I might be interested." So Neil and I collaboratively and really beautifully became a kindred spirits also in this pursuit of doing studio visits, of being able to support the local creative economy by purchasing art from a lot of the galleries. It became really lovely to be able to see him be kind of come into patronage. And I have these radical ideas that I want other developers to see the energy, to see that people stay in those buildings longer, that it builds a community through this sort of glance and perspective of the artists, of how they are framing the stories and the challenges and the different kinds of narratives that they're trying to present in their work. And so it's become a hotspot, I would say, particularly in the Warehouse District, where at one time there were three galleries there, and now there is only Yards Projects that made it out of the pandemic. So for those other developers, I really believe that just like accreditation for ADA accessibility or LEED certified building, they have something that's called WELL certification, where art can be of vital importance as we move forward to make the environment, the atmosphere of these spaces healthier, and to encourage people to engage in what is this moment of epidemic levels of loneliness and isolation. I see these as being, convening and connective experience for the residents that are in these buildings. And also the investment by people who are developers, rather than looking at gentrification that happens to be going in a lot of different pockets of Cleveland, to create buildings that are fluid, that are that provide space for block club parties or meetings, different kinds of. We do a lot of nonprofit fundraisers there at no cost. So we can help support other political, civic, and cultural entities that are really trying to climb back after the pandemic.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, it sounds like an amazing, amazing model.
You mentioned that you co-founded Zygote Press. Can you tell us what prompted you to start a nonprofit printmaking studio? And what was it like working with a co-founder?
So everything I think that has been entrepreneurial has been because there was a challenge. And at Zygote, I was understanding that there was a gap. There was a big, huge hole. And unless you were connected to a continuing education class at a university, or you had your own press, there was no access for you to be able to continue making your work. I've gone to Bob Blackburn's printmaking studio, this epic mecca that was formerly the Atelier 17 of William Stanley Hayter. And after World War II, he brought his press over and started this amazing printmaking collaborative and basically birthed all of these other printmakers to start opening university print shops that then spawned a whole bunch of other independent nonprofit print shops. And so I had gone to New York City right after I had graduated from Cranbrook, and I had it was like 90 degrees, and it, I went up to the fourth floor in this like sweltering shop, smelled like BO, and I'm just sort of like is so impressed at 30 people working in the shop at one time. And when I came back, I was still teaching at Cleveland Institute of Art, and Joe Sroka, who I'm a twin, and Joe is also a twin. We loved this idea of he was going to be graduating and I was going to be sort of going to take some other jobs in adjunct faculty teaching. So we decided to start. We both were bartenders and waitresses, and we were making a really good bank. And so we decided to pull our resources together and to be able to rent a space that was 2,500 square feet for $150 each. And mind you, Joe and I made that really in a shift. So that tells you about the real estate opportunities and vacant spaces here in Cleveland. Yeah. We have a full city at half price. So I couldn't have done this in Chicago. I couldn't have done this in probably any other area, but maybe Detroit. So we joined forces, and then two people joined us, Kelly Novak, who was from Cleveland Institute of Art, and Bellamy Prince was out in Seattle, and she was going to be moving back here. I did not know her. She literally cold called me, and she said, I heard that you're opening a press. I would love to be a part of it. And so I said, come on down. And so having that openness, she's always so tickled that I was just like, I would love for you to be a part of this. And so the four of us became the founders, and we all were probably not paid for about 6 years of developing it. We all just pitched money into the hat. We started to become a nonprofit, and we got our first grant from the Ohio Arts Council, which really snowballed our respect and our integrity from getting it from other foundations. And it just grew and started to prosper. And then we became adults. And so we started to get meager wages, and we started to get more organized and manage ourselves. We started to say, you know, let's have a gallery and let's have residencies. And so it really kind of burst organically. Zygote, a lot of people always ask me what that means. And zygote is the separating cells in twins that just is part of the gestation period. And we loved how that reflected the idea of printmaking and making multiples. And so it's really, really caught on. And we often say we have to watch what's in the water at Zygote because Bellamy had twins. So so the flourishing of Zygote, now well into its 28th year, is just wonderful. Jackie Feldman is the executive director now, and she's kicking butt. And it's just really wonderful to see all the new iterations and new, you know, the new ways in which they're really dynamically connecting with cross-sector energies in terms of writers and the literary arts and so much more. So I still print there. And so it's just really fantastic that this set of new eyes has been able to really move into directions that I'm so proud of. And as being a person that was affiliated with Zygote, and to know that it is continuing to flourish. Bellamy always used to say, we want, if we are ever hit by a bus, we want this to continue. And I was like, let's change that. Let's just say, what happens if we win the lottery and we end up going to Tahiti? Let's use that instead.
I like the fact that Bellamy Prince is a printmaker.
Yes, I do too.
Yeah.
It's what's on her bumper sticker, and her name is spelled P-R-I-N-T-Z. So it's, a lot of people think it's a vanity name change, but it's not.
So what was it? How did Bellamy hear about you from Seattle? Was there some personal, like second or third connection or something?
So her late husband, his family was from here, and he had unfortunately been terminally diagnosed with cancer. He was in remission, but they came back here the second time. And so Bellamy knew that she was moving back here. And the first time she was here, she had become friends with Holly Morrison, who was the head of etching and printmaking at the time. And so Holly actually was very pivotal in the Zygote story because she lived in a Hive building. Her studio was there. And so that's exactly where we decided to put Zygote.
Gotcha.
So serendipity.
Yeah.
That's twice. Because you got the call the first time, yeah. So I just want to go back. So the second part of that question was, what was it like working with a co-founder? But in this case, co-founders. What was the dynamic?
I loved it. I think a lot of times we find ourselves all having different skill sets. And I am not a great public speaker. So Bellamy would always be the person who would be the person who was sort of the presenter in the face of Zygote and doing a lot more of the conversations and different kinds of interviews that you guys are so beautiful at. Joe had really great tech skills. Kelly had great professional and technical skills and actually printmaking. I was the dot connector, the opportunity finder. I love to be the sort of cross-pollinator. Mm-hmm. And so we all worked really, really well together. And not to say that there weren't ever any issues with you know, conflicts and challenges, but I think that that makes us better. And it makes us improve our move forward, our processes, our administration of Zygote. And I think it's core to being somebody who is in the real world working with other people. And so I thought, I'm an adapter. So I thought it was really, I couldn't have ever imagined running it myself. And often people are like, don't you have like the founder syndrome? And I couldn't be happier to be proud of that as kind of my other child, as I've got a lot of things to do.
Yeah.
And that's just one of many. And that's the way I look at it. I look at it as like a proud aunt.
That's awesome. Well, your work is amazing. I really enjoyed cruising the web and checking out a lot of your work. Are you still focused on maintaining your art practice, or are you primarily focused on managing all these artist support organizations that you're involved in?
I just came from a huge solo show called Life is Brutiful. And it's also a component is a book project by an author named Richie Paperinen and a book that's published by Red Giant Books called Octopus Hunting. Richie is a data scientist and knows Cleveland and Rust Belt cities better than anybody. And I followed him regarding how he sees this city and the ebb and flow of our health and wellness in decline in these industrial, post-industrial spaces. And I would always take whatever he was talking about, whether it was economic, whether it was healthcare, I would always put art and culture into the sort of line item that he was talking about. And he and I became friends closer friends, but I had always followed his op-eds. He works a lot with Cleveland Foundation and Greater Cleveland Partnership. And so I started following him when my brother was dying of glioblastoma. And Richie had just been diagnosed as my brother was transitioning. And so Richie's book and the work that I was making at the time also was serendipitous of being sort of conversing about these different types of conversations that we were having both internally and that we were having also externally about the city. And so that show just came down at Hedge Gallery, and it had, I think, over 50 pieces in the show. Nice. And we had the book launch there. I just couldn't have been more thrilled to be able to come closer to this individual that I think is really tremendous and has done has been such a great voice and reporter and recorder of what's happening in Cleveland. I'm very active in my own practice. I have both the community practice, which I see a lot of supporting artists as an extension of the way I strategize, I cultivate, I structure concepts, and I move forward in those ways using my gut first, my heart, and probably my head last.
So you're really building an ecosystem is what you've been doing for the past many years.
I do feel really that it's really important. Even when I was teaching the studio courses versus the courses that I'm teaching right now at Cleveland State, I would make my own work while I was showing how to do a process. They could see me pulling my own prints, and they could see me see those prints in exhibitions. And so I was walking the walk and having the same kind of failures and the same kind of doubts and sort of missteps as they were able to see me as an older model of where they could see themselves heading. Mm-hmm. And so I feel really strongly that I am participating in an ecosystem right now where those that came before me, I've learned from all of their different kinds of pathways and the marks that they've made. Currently right now at Yards, we have a show up that's called Sage Wisdom. And there's seven artists that are well into their 70s and 80s who have been making art for over five decades in this region. And they are like this royal guard of Cleveland. And so it's been really beautiful to celebrate them. And the outpouring of love, we just had that opening last week. It was one of the largest receptions we had. And they were just floored. They were just so heart swelling to how many people came out to support them. Hmm. And certainly they've supported all of these generations. Many of them are teachers. They're people who do, you know, Parade the Circle and these huge epic community events. And very few people actually knew so much about their own creative practice. So to celebrate them in all these different ways was... It's just, it was great.
That's great. Amazing.
So I also see that you founded the Collective Arts Network. It's a quarterly journal, online resource, and arts consortium that promotes Northeast Ohio artists and organizations. Just wanted to say that for the listeners. What prompted you to do that, and has it been impactful?
Yes. I just came from an event last night celebrating our 10 years at CAN. And it was at Tinnerman Lofts, which is the sister building of Yards, Worthington Yards and Yards Projects. The celebration was supporters who had funded these beautiful tomes of all of the 10 years of the quarterly journal and their support that has been just, we couldn't have done it without them. And so it was really a wonderful party to honor them. And CAN started as Mike Gill, who is the editor and publisher and the executive director of CAN Journal, it started because he was a printmaker too. And he was starting to learn how to create using letterpress and to create handmade books. He was a out of work writer, a paper, a local paper had just folded. And so he was there and had all these other wicked skills, writing about art and the politics of art and what was going on here in the city. And so we had found that post-recession that that we were really hit hard here in Cleveland, Ohio. And so a lot of organizations were really struggling, particularly with getting the message out. We only had one media outlet and one person that covered the news. And that wasn't good enough for us because that one person wasn't necessarily coming in any of our directions. It was maybe the writing that we might see in our local plain dealer was more things like the Cleveland Museum of Art or the, right. The sort of tested and true.
Yeah, the establishment.
Institution. Yes. So I said, why don't we all pull together different galleries, and why don't we all throw $100 in the hat? Let's all pick each other's name out of the hat and let's write about each other for 1 year. And let's use the Plain Dealer and let's print like a newspaper, the Plain Dealer kind of printer. We didn't use the Plain Dealer, but we used their printer. And we ended up making 10,000 of these papers that talked about collective energies that have happened in the arts here in Cleveland. So Michael took that to task. We had a map of all the organizations. We had what their year schedule looked like. And so it was really beautiful because I had actually picked the Sculpture Center. And so somebody else picked Zygote Press. And so we became friends. And then we had a big launch party and everybody came to pick up their, we made 10,000 of them and everybody came to pick up their newspaper so they can distribute them in their own neighborhoods. And then, and that was through a one-to-one match through the Ohio Arts Council. So we had 16 organizations starting and then it just basically flourished because of one of the people we were honoring last night, Wally Lancy of Consolidated Solutions, who said, hey, I will give you, through my company, we will support you for the first 2 years, but it needs to look better. It needs to be on better paper. And so the Can Journal was made possible beyond that 1 year idea. And it just kind of grew into something that, you know, who knew 10 years later it would grow into this. I'm a proud board member. And they've just been flourishing in coverage. My students are now writing. My art history students are writing. And I'm doing critical reviews for CAN. So it's really become full circle.
Yeah. It's nice.
Yeah. And getting paid for it.
Yeah. There that's you go. Amazing.
Yeah.
Why 10,000? That seems ambitious for the first one. How did you arrive at 10,000?
Well, I think we decided to kind of we did hire a person that first year to distribute it in different outlets of coffee shops.
And so you had a plan for get distribution. Okay.
Yeah.
It wasn't just the price break.
No, and it's in every library. It's in all of the public spaces that.
That's awesome.
That we could distribute it as far as that goes, but gotcha. It's a beautiful magazine that I'm so proud of Mike and his staff and what's been able to just do all kinds of miraculous things. So now it's printed quarterly, 10,000, and we have a distribution party that we call Can Launches at all these different galleries all around Northeast Ohio. And people come and they pick up, they pick up their boxes of Can. I'm almost like it's like like we're kind of like drug dealers or something because people are so excited to come and get so they can, you know, let me get this back, let me get my story out about the artists that are showing in our galleries, about the the workshops we're doing. And it's really citizen journalism from the arts that we can count on, that we can use our own voice. And it goes out to, and it maximizes the amount of people that we can go out to versus it being something that the old school, we were making our little postcards or sending out our emails that were on our own email lists. And so this way it really, this way it was really much more effective and cost efficient during this very hard time post-recession.
And is it only visual arts or do you do other things, music, things like
that? It's only visual arts.
Okay. Just want to make sure. And we'll link to it in the show notes so people can check it out.
Is it, and it's free for somebody to grab one and read it?
It's free. And it's beautiful. It's won all kinds of awards, best magazine in Ohio. And all different kinds of wonderful things, that have really been pivotal for CAN to, tell stories. And, you know, it, at times it's been bilingual when we've had, you know, how it's been in different neighborhoods. And so they're continuing to really try to support the historically underrepresented with stories of, you know, smaller grassroots organizations that are in different neighborhoods that many might even say that there's not a lot of stuff going in those neighborhoods. Culturally, but we all know that there are. So it's really kind of highlighted a lot of those and a lot of artists too that have had a lack of feeling valued or seen. And so it's been really beautiful for those artists too to have you know, something that goes back to their name.
What a, and 10 over 10, you know, 10 years of those releases, what a treasure trove of history. You know, for that region and the arts.
So it, arts. You know, especially over CAN, I mean, over the, the pandemic. CAN was one of those, you know, what do we do
what
when
happened?
When everybody was shelter in place? And so there were, different kinds of stories and strategies and ways in which, that one sticks out to me because we had all of the artists that had, masks on that were on the cover of the CAN. So politically, how many of the folks in our cultural community were just really struggling at that time and to really put that out there. And so we also tried to make it that even the cost of participating in CAN was really, we got grants to be able to cover those costs during CAN, so everybody could still help process a time where they weren't making money at their own organizations and galleries as they were closed.
I'm also imagining, so that first year was sort of the experiment, and then somebody said, okay, do this for two more years. Now you have to kind of switch gears a little bit and think about, rather than just getting this thing started, how do we give it legs or whatever?
Well, if it wasn't for this Wally Lancey Consolidated Solutions, we would not have been where we are. It would have been a one-off. And he really believed in a lot of arts and cultural organizations that he supported through his printing. And our printing with him for the, you know, the entirety of that time were where we could pay for it. But he gave us that seed money to kind of get this sexy journal off the ground and to get it into people's hands. And it sure as hell worked.
Well, he had the proof of concept. So he saw that, saw the passion likely, and said, let's see if this thing has legs.
That's awesome. So networking and networks, that's a huge part of what, of the work that you've been describing to us so far. And we talk about that with guests on this show a lot, primarily because Nick and I work with artists, you know, college-aged artists who are just beginning to think about that notion of networking or what is networking. And then I guess that's the question I want to pose to you is, you know, what does networking and utilizing your network or leveraging your network or leaning on your network, whatever you want to call it, what does that look like for you?
There was a show I was in that was about my community engaged practice at Mocha Cleveland. And it was back in 2012. And there was a lot of things that were going on with arts funding for individual artists. And because I had this platform, and because I think artists were, that there was transparency issues, there were issues with artists being involved in the policies that were coming down from a cigarette tax, public funding. And because I had this moment to talk about, you know, my own art, and which includes connecting with community, I invited others into this exhibition, and the piece was called The Artist Trust of Cuyahoga County. And to put trust out there and to invite artists to make an 8.5 by 11 portrait of themselves and to be able to participate in the show. Many artists, and this is anybody who was 18 or over, could participate. And so I got over 550 artists in the exhibition. And from that, I built a very rudimentary database that had their picture, their name, their website if they had one, and their email. And so it was probably one of the largest exhibitions, attending exhibitions, especially from local artists at MoCA. Mm. MoCA had just, you know, they have a new fancy building, mm-hmm. and a lot of local artists didn't necessarily see themselves represented there. And so this show, with my work among other artists that were included in the show, really was about how they impact community, how they think about community, how the community impacts them. And so from that experience, we started another larger database through the administration of Gordon Square Arts District, who was known for performing arts, but wanted to expand it to the literary arts and the visual arts. And so they decided to want to build out a larger website that that was all representing Cleveland artists. And so and performers and dancers and writers and filmmakers and designers. And the Cleveland Artist Network was born. And now that has been shifted over to the Assembly for the Arts, and they are actually expanding it with the same people that we were criticizing, with part of the Assembly for the Arts and Cuyahoga Arts and Culture. But at the time, you know, if you wanted to look up a Cleveland artist or writer or poet, there was no way for you to get in touch with them. And so we sort of expanded the search engines for that. So specific neighborhoods, demographics, how people wanted to identify, they could upload. It was free. Mm. And so there were no barriers for if you didn't have the tech skills of building your own website, getting the domain, all that stuff. This was just something that was collectively for everybody. And so for my students, this shift happened this year. So this, even this year, I make it my students' business that they have to sign up for the CAN blog. They have to sign up to the Cleveland Artist Network. They have to do all of these things to get their names and to start that, to start that extension away from their own nervousness and self-doubt and imposter syndrome, mm-hmm. and actually just kind of get themselves out there. I make them all make business cards.
That's great.
For my assignments, I make them go to these arts walks that we have twice a year at 78th Street Studios and at Walk Oliver Waterloo, many that they've never been to before. They don't even know they exist.
Yeah.
They have to do 3 exhibition reviews. They have to do arts advocacy work, and they have to interview people about whatever their self-interest is in arts advocacy They have to go to a Cuyahoga Arts and Culture Board meeting or an assembly meeting and write about it and discuss it with in the sort of Socratic method of our of our classroom. So, man, I teach it and I preach it, and and it's really important, and it gives them to sort of a terrain of what the landscape looks like. And my other job at Cleveland State University is as the Haddad Art Mentor, and it's really tried to get paid internships for these students to get paid gigs, so they understand, you know, what they're looking at and how to move forward in being able to negotiate, being able to know what they're worth, and to not do it for free.
Yeah, it's great.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, please subscribe. Visit artsentrepreneurshippodcast.com to learn more about our guest and how you can help support artists, the arts, and this podcast.